This is Father Gregory Pine.
This is Father Joseph Anthony Kress.
And welcome to Godsplaining. Thanks to all those who support the podcast. If you enjoy Godsplaining, please consider making a monthly donation on Patreon. Be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get the goods. Father Joseph Anthony.
Hey.
So here we are in, where are we? Lincoln, Nebraska.
We're in a cornfield, to be quite honest. It's a cornfield in Nebraska.
Okay, so we're in Lincoln, Nebraska. Yeah. How did we come to be here in Lincoln, Nebraska? How would you explain that? You could do the historical approach. You could do like the genealogical approach. You could do like the metaphysical approach. How did we come to be here?
I got on a plane and then got in a rental car.
Nice. Okay, one way.
This has been in the works for a while.
Yes.
It has been a few months, and we are lucky enough to get an invitation from the Diocese of Lincoln to come out and support the young adult community here, which is a beautiful community and happy to be a part of that. And so we've been here a little over a day or so and gave a full day's retreat to the young adult community out here and are able to share in a lot with them. And yeah, I think it's a great opportunity. It's a new kind of endeavor for us. Mm-hmm. It's something new that we're kind of testing, dipping our toes into those mm-hmm. waters a little bit, and doing these kind of retreats and days of reflections or things like that in a broader geographic footprint.
Mm-hmm.
So going a little more outside of our normal kind of day's trip striking distance.
Yeah.
So it's exciting to kind of branch out a little more and see amber waves of grain in this great country.
Exactly.
And bring the gospel to it.
Waving wheat.
Yeah. It is windy out here, though.
It
I'm
is
not
windy.
Gonna lie.
Yeah.
There's no mountains, nothing to break it up.
No. Yeah, so as we do often on the podcast, we take every opportunity to make fun of Father Patrick Briscoe.
There it is.
So he suggested, like, we should do days of recollection. And I'm just a drudge in the army of the Lord, a grunt, as it were. And so I'm like, I will do it. So we planned some. This was at the invitation of Miss Jen Heffernan. So cheers, Jen Heffernan. Let's go. And it seems like, yeah, like a good opportunity to bop in and bop out of places where we might not otherwise be.
Mm-hmm,
But then Father Patrick promptly double booked himself for every single one of our now it's 3 days
1,000%
of recollection.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like he forgot or something, you know. When truth be told, he was looking at his calendar and going, I'm just going to purchase these tickets.
You should definitely do that. Yeah. I can't do that.
Come on, bro.
So, classic Father Patrick. But, you know, God brings good out of Father Patrick's evil.
Yeah.
So we're delighted to be here. Yeah. All right. Now thinking about Catholic life here in the great state of Nebraska, the vibes that we've been picking up have been ecclesial vibes.
Big vibes.
So it seems like people here like to be members of the body of Christ. They like to be, you know, part of the church, which is sweet. But then, you know, people are asking, they're out there asking, how do I live my Christian life? Okay. At what point can I begin living my Christian life? How do I seek God in the midst of my Christian life? So what are some principles that we can set out for like thinking well specifically about Christian life, spiritual life, contemplative life here?
Well, I think the question is when do I begin? At what point am I kind of equipped enough? Do I feel like I can launch into this? And the answer is you will never be ready.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's never a point where you're like, okay, I've hit enough milestones where I'm good to go here. Like there's no certification to say like, I am a Christian, I see my certificate. It just, we begin right now, right? And so I think the reality is that you begin where you are. You know, I feel like I'm, an Instagram post and saying just like, you know, bloom where you're planted and just like begin where you are, right? And the Lord loves us in this moment. The Lord gives us his grace that is sufficient for this day. And there's nothing that holds us back. And so where do we begin to live this Christian life in the context that we are is the reality that our state of life, our location, the individuals around us for this moment are gifts of God to us at this moment. We don't have to wait for the exterior circumstances to change to be more conducive to a Christian life before we can start living the Christian life. But what we have around us are God's gift to us for this moment, and we can live in union with him beginning in the here and now. So I think the first thing that we have to realize is we can express a desire or a longing for things to get better, things to change and to do better, to grow into this in a certain maturity. But we don't have to wait for that in order to begin. We can just pick it up right here, right now.
Yeah. There's an early 20th century author named Charles Peguy who says that modern man is haunted by the fear that his real life is elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's true of many of us to some degree or extent. Like we think, you know, I'll really be off and running as soon as I finish my degree, or as soon as I am in the paid position that I imagine for myself, or as soon as I am married, settled with kids, or as soon as I am dead, you know, whatever else.
Like a dark room.
Yeah, that's just me.
Projecting out here.
but the point of kind of meditating along these lines is to say simply, right, no, our real life is here. Yeah. Right? It's to be had by going through, you know, these circumstances rather than around them or over them or under them, or kind of turning our gaze away from them for fear that they are non-optimal or non-maximal or otherwise discomforting or dispiriting or whatever. So like, this is our real life, and not in the sense like, exasperation, disappointment, this is my real life, but in the sense like, this is my real life.
Yeah.
You don't have to be pumped about it. I mean, maybe you're discouraged about it, but it's just what it is. Mm-hmm. Okay, so given the fact that it is what it is, how are you going to seek the Lord and then the Christian community that you described in the midst of it? And I think that here, you know, like while there isn't a certification for adequate Christian maturity, there is baptism, which is not nothing in the sense that God has bestowed upon us his divine life. And he says, use it. He doesn't say like, put it in a trophy case. And when you have visitors, you know, gesture them to the part of the house in which your baptismal graces are enshrined. Yeah. He says, no, like use them. I mean, grace is for you to use, which sounds almost, like strange. Like I get to use grace. Yeah, you get to use grace because grace isn't God. So you get to use basically everything apart from God. I mean, we're not looking like used people, but you get the idea. Okay, so we are meant to use grace. So I think that sets us up then to think about like living our contemplative lives, being on the lookout for God and being abandoned to whatever it is that God furnishes so that we can, you know, love him in the midst of it and seek to grow and abide in that love. So, okay, next steps, we have some initial steps there mapped out, but how then do you think we can describe the contemplative life in maybe more practical or concrete terms?
Yeah, this concept of the contemplative life in a modern world, a contemporary world, whatever you want to say with it, it's somebody we've talked about in the past, but Father Donald Haggerty, who is a priest in New York City, he writes on the contemplative life. He has a number of books about it. And I personally love them and really have appreciated how he talks about the contemplative life. Because he says this contemplative life is actually the vocation of every single baptized person. Mm-hmm. Like there's nobody that has received baptism that is exempt from the contemplative life. It's not just for the introverts. And like, I need to hear that because I'm an extrovert. I need to be around people. And I get this concept that the introvert is more natural to a contemplative life. And you know what? That just might not be for me. So I'll let them do that thing. But no, it's for every single one of us. Is we, through our baptism, are called to contemplate and sit in the presence and seek the face of Jesus Christ. And to sit in that presence and stare at that and to receive his gaze as we return that look of love. And so this life of contemplation, to sit in the presence and to contemplate the mysteries of God, is the call of our baptism. And so, yes, it is a struggle. Yes, it's going to be difficult to figure out how to do that in a modern, active society. But it's not to be relegated to the uber pious people who, you know, run off to a monastery or anything like that. So I think reading Father Donald's books and talking about how to be a contemplative in the daily life is super helpful because he does introduce it as part of our just Christian identity. And so I think the first thing is like, when we look at it is like, this is part of my identity. This is part of my core of who I am, who I'm called to be, who I'm created to be, as one who contemplates and the mysteries of God. And so that's an endeavor worth setting off on. Like that's something worth integrating into my daily life and maybe even protecting in some senses, is that it then fuels the rest of my activities. It gives the lens through which I see the rest of my relationships, is understanding that kind of core relationship of God is to strive towards contemplating his mysteries in my life.
Yeah, I think it's helpful when talking about the contemplative life along the lines that you just set forth to clarify that is, wow, that is a great introductory phrase. Mm-hmm. Contemplative life, what do we mean by it? Well, I think that we mean too much and we mean too little. Mm-hmm. In the sense mm-hmm. that we expect too much, like we expect to levitate and we expect to bilocate and we expect to have like powerful, consoling experiences mm-hmm. of the indwelling Trinity. When, I don't know that many people experience that, even yeah. people whom we could appropriately call contemplatives. Okay, so it seems like we're expecting too much or we're expecting the wrong things. But I also think that we're expecting too little mm-hmm. in the sense that we don't think that a lot of our life's experience can bear that grace for us. And so we kind of relegate it to or circumscribe it within times of prayer.
Yeah.
It's like, for the most part, you know, let's say I'm awake for 18 hours a day and I'm hustling for like 15 and a half and I'm praying for like $1.15 and then I get like an hour and 15 to just stare into space or look at a wall. It's like, okay. So if that's the case, I would say, well, let's think about one, getting more sleep. Okay, let's see if we can go from 6 to 7, 7.5 even. That'd be delicious. And then beyond that, let's think about the whole of your life as potentially lived in intimacy, like in union with God.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, narrowly kind of relegating it to or circumscribing it within those times of prayer and then thinking the rest of one's life as the hustle. Because I think what a contemplative recognizes is that he or she can have God closer than everything else.
Yeah.
It's to have God closer than everything else. And part of what makes life distracting or dispersing or otherwise dispiriting is that the pain and the suffering seems to get real close.
Yeah,
like it gets in your pores and it gets under your skin and you like, you know, you got your fingernails just completely gunked up with the pain and the suffering. And it's just unimaginable that anything else could be closer to you than that. Mm-hmm. But God says, I want to be closer to you than that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'll help you like navigate the pain and the suffering. I might even alleviate it. Chances are low, but just heads up. But I can be closer to you than it. And I think the contemplative is the one who has the hunger and the thirst for that, and then the openness to it. And rather than saying, I'm going to foreclose on the possibility of that type of intimacy because keeping myself open to it is just too troubling, right? It's just like too ugh-ing. So I'm going to keep that open. I'm going to keep that open with a kind of vulnerability to allow God to have his way, even if his way doesn't look like what I might script it to look like.
But I mean, in that sense, this is like, doesn't that seem to be a little more exhausting? Right? Because if it's like, if I can just compartmentalize and keep my little God box over here for $1.15 a day, and said I did my contemplation thing, I looked at my icon, I lit my candles, I prayed my rosary, you know, I read the daily readings, then I can go about my day. But if I have to keep that open for the rest of my day, because I'm always trying to be close to the Lord, but doesn't that, in a certain sense, it seems to be more exhausting, so it's less enticing. But I don't think it is, right? I think if we're in a certain sense, when we try to overpack our prayer hour, which we should have dedicated time for the Lord, I'm not trying to rail against that. But I think it's like if you're trying to overpack it, like you're trying to stuff a suitcase that you know is a carry-on because you don't want to pay the $35 to get the check bag. But I think when you present it that way is the contemplative is one who's constantly seeking that the Lord be the most intimate, the most present to him. That actually becomes a stable disposition. And it doesn't take the energy. It doesn't become this exhausting thing where I'm constantly looking for the Lord, where you become able to have that kind of intimacy in him that close to you, that it doesn't take away your energy. It doesn't take away your life or take away your identity. It actually becomes more intimate than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, within that setting, then you have to ask like what fits and what doesn't fit.
Right.
It's not a mere matter of like, all right, is this a sin or is this permitted? Because yeah, there's a certain person who approaches his life and just wants to do what he wants to do. And then he's only going to get rid of a thing if the church reveals it as condemnatory or as punishable. But I think that within the setting of our contemplative life, we're asking a different kind of question. We're asking, like, how do I abide with him? How do I remain with him? And then that gives us eyes to see, okay, this, that, the other, is it going to fit or is it not going to fit? Like a couple years ago, I still listen to some music. I made this video, but the title of it was like, I'll never listen to music again. People title videos to get people to click. And that person is not me. So I have reined in listening to me. I used to listen to music a lot when I worked because it was like, have to make it to the end of the boring book. That's just my experience of writing a dissertation, by the way. Because yeah, I just like needed something to get me there. But then I found that it was actually, it just wasn't good because I'd wake up at like 2:17 in the morning and I'd be like slicing with Kygo and I'd be like, dude, let's go. But you don't want to be like, dude, let's go at 2:17 in the morning. You want to be asleep. So my imagination was getting populated by sweet, you know, Kygo drops.
Yeah.
Because as good as the first drop is, the second drop is that much better.
Always hits.
Yeah, exactly.
Always hits.
Yeah, and it hits like you wouldn't believe at 2 in the morning. So I like made the decision, like I want to be present to the Lord. And when I wake up after having been interrupted throughout the course of a night's sleep by tropical house music, then I just resent the Lord for an hour in the morning and call that a holy hour.
Yeah.
It's like, why did you make me this way? So I made like a little move to kind of distance myself from popular music, which easily colonized my imaginative dreamscape. So I think that, like, you know, we have to ask the questions like that. But I don't know what your experience of, you know, living your contemplative life and then counseling your students as it concerns, you know, like what's in, what's out, what fits, what doesn't.
I don't know. It's this is where prudence, I think, really is key, you know. There's a QR code in the back. Like I did.
Nice. That was straight.
It's true. Prudence is very important as a way to, you know, start to orient and direct our how we do this, the actions which and the steps that we take to accomplish this, to create this intimate disposition with us. So yeah, I think it's going to be something where I'll sit down with a student and we start to work through it and we start to see like, okay, you know, the bare bones basics, like, okay, are you sleeping? Are you eating? Are you praying? What does this look like? Then one of the things I found myself talking to my students a lot about recently is go through your day, go through your week, and what are the obligations of your state of life that are outside your control, that are already like put in there? You know, for most of my students, it's their course schedule, you know, so they know that they have an 8 a.m. class and they didn't choose that, like it got assigned. So you may get upset and angry because like, no, I can't go to 8 a.m. mass and like mass is the most important. So it's like, dude, you got two other masses to go to. Like there's an obligation that is of your state of life that is imposed on you. So you put all of those in there, and then from that place, you put in your prayer time, you put in exercise, you put in these other things. But I think a lot of people get really frustrated with their state of life, of the obligations of their state of life, instead of taking account of that and then working within that. Because like I said, once again, our state of life, our context, our you know, living conditions and friends and people in our life, these are all gifts of God, so we shouldn't... we should take account of them first.
Yeah. There's a sense in which we need to be obedient to our experience, not in that we let our experience kind of tug us about by the nose and just send us hither and thither, but we need to account for it. Like we can't just wish it away or wish it otherwise.
Yeah.
We have to account for it in conversation with God and then, you know, set each thing in its proper place by a kind of order which God gives. Okay, so then thinking about some of those secondary goods, obviously, like if Christian life were a mere matter of optimizing and maximizing, then we would just go to 6 a.m. Mass, 6:30 a.m. Mass, 7 a.m. Mass, 7:30 a.m. Mass, 8 a.m. Mass. You see where this is going. Right, so we would just go to 17 masses, receive at 2, and then feel guilty for whatever other waking hours that we spent outside of the chapel.
Yeah.
Because heaven forfend that you do anything suboptimal or non-maximal. But as it turns out...
Don't even get me started on
that. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
As it turns out, Christian life is not about that. And not in the sense it's like, live your best life and wear bro tanks. But in the sense that like the Lord is calling us to a peculiar and particular intimacy to reflect His glory in a way that's uniquely suited to us. Okay, so if that's the case, then how do we respond to that with generosity, right? But with a real sense of abandon. Like, I'm going to live my life not in a spirit of selfishness, but in a spirit of abandon, which actually reflects the nature of this call rather than just justifying selfishness or idiosyncrasy. So how do you help people? How do we help people to live their lives?
I think it's that aspect of not being afraid to recognize your uniqueness and that there is a unique unrepeatability, that I have strengths, gifts, talents, passions that you don't. And praise Jesus, right?
Like audio.
Yes. Like, and you have strengths, gifts, talents, and passions that I don't have. And praise Jesus.
Yeah.
And to not, I think people are actually very afraid, I've seen, to claim something as a passion of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
To claim something as, this is uniquely mine. You know, I love aviation. You know, I love flying, so I love listening to live ATC recordings at airports because I'm a nerd and I don't know why. And I like just saying the alphabet, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, you know, I'm C22 Echo, thank you very much. I don't know why, but I love that stuff. But I think people see those unique things that give them a slight little glimpse of joy and they feel ashamed.
Mm.
And I've never, I don't think there's anything to shame that, that we should be afraid of in that. So I think one of the things that we can do is encourage each other and ask each other about the unique things that we have in our lives. We talk a lot about building up trust with people and building up vulnerability-based trust within our campus ministry. And one of the ways you do that is you get to know a person, right? And sometimes the easiest things to do is talk about childhood things. So it's like, hey, give me your favorite story from fifth grade, you know, and just give these things that kind of break open somebody's life and let you know they're so much more multidimensional than maybe the facade that we initially encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that too is to understand our gifts, our hobbies, our passions, that all of these good things can draw us back to the Lord in many respects. And so to not be afraid that we do have unique unrepeatability things and to actually claim the uniqueness for each one of us.
Yeah. Okay, well then, against that backdrop, let's think a little bit about UVA sports.
Mm.
So you are the chaplain at the University of Virginia.
Yes, sir.
How does this go? Wahoo-wah?
Wahoo-wah.
Okay, thank you. All right. So, you know, like you're into University of Virginia sports. I'm into sports of my own choosing, which would be those associated with the city of Philadelphia, the city of champions, the greatest city in the world.
Go Birds.
Yeah, and it's like you might think that, you know, at this point in our Christian lives, in our religious lives, in our priestly lives, that we would have set childish things aside, that we would have been contented with milk and instead on to the world of solid food. Uh-huh. But here we are. And I don't think it's because we haven't matured beyond the limited compass of our sporting interests.
Uh-uh, uh-uh.
At least when I'm self-justifying this practice, I don't think that. Mm. But like, does sports still fit in our life?
Yes.
Okay. And if so, how?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So what do you think?
Sports are a beautiful thing. And they've always had, I think they have a place in the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
In watching the competitive spirit, which I think in the proper arena is a good outlet, you know, and sports are a good outlet for that. I think that it's also an aspect of, you know, training the body in our humanity. So body and soul unity, right? And how we learn discipline with our body. Working with so many athletes at the University of Virginia, which has a fantastic athletics program, we have great coaches and athletes, but one of the things and one of the reasons I love working with college athletes is they are already rigorously disciplined, right? They have to get up, they have, you know, get up at 4 a.m. because they gotta be in the locker rooms by 5:30 because they're on the field at 6 and get all these workouts in before you even hit the classrooms at 8 o'clock. And they tend to have this concept of discipline already built into them. And that's not necessarily punishing the body, and that's not trying to beat it into submission, but that's disciplining and orienting the body in a direction. And that might mean withholding from certain things, fried foods and, you know, weekend frat parties because mm-hmm. you're in the ACC tournament,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I think there's a good for the athlete themselves. And the risk though, right, is that their identity comes from their production in the field. And that's really, really hard, especially when you see an athlete get an injury, or maybe their time of athletic prowess comes to an end,
mm.
you know? So one of the things is when I work with the athletes, I try not to introduce them according to their sport. So I won't say like, hey, here's Joey, he's a football player. Yeah, bro, 6'8 and like 260, everybody knows he's a football player, you know? But try to introduce him according to a different characteristic. Like, hey, here's Joey, he's got one of the greatest laughs you'll ever hear. And then he just immediately starts going, like on cue. But it's important to recognize and build up that our identity is not necessarily in the thing itself. But I think also sports provide something else for not just the athlete, but those around, right? It really does create a sense of community. It creates a certain passion. We were talking on the way over in the rental car, is like, there is no more heartbreak, right? Mm. Than watching your team like just get all the way to the championship and just like lose by a sliver, you know? But it creates a sense of unity and passion because it draws people together in either joy or celebration or even heartbreak sometimes. So there's a positivity of the athletics and sports for athletes as individuals, but I also think for larger communities, because it gives something that is in a certain sense safe to draw people together around.
Yeah, I think that, you know, like when talking about our contemplative lives, about our Christian lives, and trying not to espouse a totalizing logic which just lays waste certain human elements which contribute to our flourishing, I think that we just have to keep in mind like what's primary and what's secondary.
Totally.
You know, so primary is our relationship with God and those whom God entrusts to our care, or those whom God mediates his life in and through. And then what's secondary are the things that fit in light of that, given who you are, the time, the place, the circumstances, where you were born, what language you speak, the things that you love, etc. And I think that each of those things, you know, it has a place. A bigger place or a smaller place, but that place is to be identified and then to be embraced kind of by comparison to what's most important.
Totally.
So it's like secondary and primary, always in light of the fact that it's secondary, we refer to the primary. And I think that, like, you know, as a Philadelphia sports fan, I go through periods of thinking like, this is the best thing ever and I want to be here always. And I'll never watch another game because my heart simply can't be broken in this matter one more time before I die. Yeah, like living in Switzerland, I woke up for the Super Bowl at, you know, I think I went to bed at 7:45 p.m. just to get out ahead of the fatigue that was inevitably going to claim me. But I woke up, you know, like 12:30 or 1 a.m. to watch the Super Bowl, and I'm like sitting in a parlor just like bundled all up because it's February and the coldest country in the world. Maybe not true, but regardless, it felt that way. At least after they lost, it felt that way. Yeah. And just like the solipsistic terror of losing a football game whilst alone in a foreign country on a Reddit stream. Nothing quite like that. Yeah, but then, okay, that being said, I'm not gonna say like, all right, let's transition into talking about when they won the Super Bowl in 2018 and how I'll always have that. And when I look at Tom Brady, I think, 41-33, sucker.
No, special.
But it's because it's not just a matter of mere like wins and losses. It's not just a mere matter of assessing, you know, whether you can endure the pain for love of, you know, like the pleasure that lies in store. It's a question of like who are you? Where are you rooted? What do you love? What do you share with people? Because I think that we have, like, there are certain common goods around which we're meant to congregate.
Yeah.
God is the common good of all the universe. Mm-hmm. But, like, we think about the family, the polity, we think about the church. And I think that these things kind of make us conversant, as it were, in humanity.
Yep.
And they make us conversant in the loves of those with whom we're called to share our life. And I don't think that's bad.
No.
I think that that's good.
I think it gets back to what you were saying, primary and secondary goods. Like, it's the problem with it is when it gets disordered. You know, I'm from Ohio. Ohio State football is a religion. You know, that's where it gets out of line, you know. There may be some other Big Ten football teams that also carry certain, you know, deistic tendencies sometimes. Don't even get me started in the SEC. Anyway, but I think it's when those things get out of order, right? When we take sports and we make it into a God, and we make it a religion in our entire lives, and it then moves out of something that is a passion and draws people together in the right place, and thus has its ability to flourish for the good of a community, right? To draw people together in its right place. And then when it gets out of order, then it becomes, you know, like almost a religion. Then we have some real questions to ask.
All right, I think a concern that people have with sports, and this will be our final point, is sports seem, at least at face value, to be belligerent in the sense that like they participate and warlike prowess. So you think about the Olympic Games, you called wars off so you could all congregate, display your military strength in alternate means, and potentially discourage further conflicts. So you'd like run real fast, and then run real fast twice as far, and then run real fast like 20 times as far.
Jumping over things.
Exactly, yeah. And then you'd have pugilism, Greco-Roman wrestling, you know, like whatever. You'd have like a bunch of throwing a discus and launching a javelin, but it was basically like, I can kill you in war, which is, you know, it's a mood.
Yeah.
But the question is whether there ought to be bounds to the belligerents. You know, there's this conversation about football and CTE, but then you can think about the conversation as it concerns boxing, like Mike Tyson is making a comeback, whether that should ever happen seems dubious.
He's fit though. Have you seen him?
He is fit, but he's also 59 years old.
I still don't want to get anywhere near that man.
I don't either, but I'm not a professional boxer.
Yeah, neither am I. Anyway, that was just...
But dare to dream. Okay, so, and then like MMA, you know, so you put people in an eight-sided room of porous nature. Yeah, let's go. And then you try to break each other's sternums, at least that's how it seems to me, if you're skilled in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So like, when you talk to people about sports, some things seem to be in, some things seem to be out, but how do we draw those lines? How do we have that conversation?
It's, there's sports that can be skills, right? And I found it's always helpful that I think each one of us have skills that we're working on and trying to perfect and strive for and always trying to better. So those things I think have their place. And I think all sports contain skills. So I think those are that one. There are other sports where it's a certain kind of combat sport, right? So MMA is one, football is definitely one. Rugby is very physical. Contact sports are, you know, combat sports. There's a risk of, you know, physical injury and harm in pretty much all sports, right? There's always a risk. But there are some where that is the actual sport itself, right? There's one thing when we talked about primary and secondary, there's one thing that's saying this is a physical, this is a physical game, and injury and risk are part of that sport. There's another where the sport itself is intending to render the person less than human. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that we have to kind of really pause and caution ourselves from saying, if the goal is to render you incapable of human, knocking you out, so that you no longer have the capacity of your intellect and will, if that's the goal of this, then that's different than saying, I'm going to exert my strength over you in a skillful way, but I want to render you less than human. I find that it's hard to reconcile that in some, but there are ways that it's like another skill set or something that is going to be, like I said, very physically demanding, and maybe injury happens, but to render a person, intentionally render them less than human, I find very problematic. And it, you know, I'm hinting at MMA here or boxing for that sense, which there's something very like, I don't know, as a man, I watch those things and I'm very much attracted to it. I want to see that. The combat sports are very enticing for me, but I have a hard time watching it at the same time.
Yeah, I think I'm about to give a series of hot takes, which I'll probably regret, but here we go.
Hello, internet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's how this works. So I think you're right. Like, I think this question of dehumanization is central, both of the agent and then of the patient.
Yeah.
That is to say, like, the person doing and then the person suffering. I think that football isn't an evil sport. My suspicion is that what's wrong with football is the padding. Because I think the padding, it actually permits you to be violent in a way that's potentially dehumanizing or dehumanized. So if they didn't wear helmets, for instance, I think you probably have a lot fewer concussions.
Well, you look at rugby.
Exactly. Like, because rugby, you're less inclined to use your head as a missile. So I think that when you pad and protect in a way to facilitate more extreme violence, that's concerning. But then boxing, it's like headgear seems to help. So it's like, I can't make this a hard and fast rule because headgear seems to prevent head injuries, where it's, you know, like the people who suffer from traumatic brain injury, from Parkinson's and things that are as a result of getting your brains addled are like, you know, the heavyweights, the welterweights. So like there's that. And then like when it concerns, I think that when the goal is to incapacitate another person, specifically by dealing sufficient trauma as to make them unfit for future participation,
right,
that's probably bad. But then, like, a chess player might say, I want to so dominate my opponent with my sweet gambit that he never comes to the table again. And then it's like, okay. You know, it's like, I don't know how much head trauma is caused by chess.
You,
I mean,
nerd.
Yeah, well, there's a Stefan Zweig short story about this thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I don't want to, like, say it's this and that and the other thing, but what worries me is the dehumanizing and the dehumanized, because then it goes beyond recreation, play, even, you know, proximate preparation for belligerence, and it just becomes its own world. And then we get back to what we began with, primary and secondary. Yeah. If you're being reduced as a human being, whether as agent or as patient, then you're losing sight of primary and secondary, and you're making of this thing an idol. If you've got all of your life invested in, you know, I think of like Alex Honnold, for instance, Free Solo.
Oh my
it's
gosh,
like,
that's
so cool, but I think it's gravely imprudent.
Yeah.
And as a result of which, I think it's a perversion of secondary and primary goods.
Yep.
You know, because I think that man's made for worship. As cool as it is to go up the side of a mountain super quickly without any ropes, I think it'd be better if he prayed. But then again, I'm a little judgment factory. So.
As well, you should be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So. All right, those are our proposals for the episode. Do you have any final thoughts or parting words?
Jesus is Lord.
Nice.
Yeah, big this, fan of that guy.
This pleases me.
Big fan of that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that it's helpful to know that your life is livable, okay? Mm-hmm. So that, like, the Lord gives you not merely what you need, but he gives you from his abundance so as to equip you for a Christian life, a spiritual life, a contemplative life wherein he can be known and loved, not necessarily sensibly or consolably, but really, and that's a matter of faith, of hope, and of love. So, boom. Okay, thanks for listening to this episode of God's Planning. Be sure to like and subscribe to God's Planning wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, X, and Instagram, and TikTok while you can. Until such time as the United States government removes that as an option, which we will all celebrate, honestly. But alas and alack, we have to promote it in the time being. Do we? It's hard to say.
I don't know.
If you follow the links in the description and or show notes, you'll find opportunities to purchase Godsplaining merchandise, to find out about upcoming Godsplaining events. And we just want to highlight the upcoming retreat, June 7th through 9th in Malvern, Pennsylvania, which will be wild. And then the men's retreat in Brevard, North Carolina, that's August, I think it's like 8th through 11th, which will also be wild. And then you'll also find links there to support us via Patreon, monthly donations for which we're supremely grateful. Okay, know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on God's Planning.